Chairman of the African People Social
Dr. Aisha Fields.
Director of the Hall of African People's Development and
President Chimurenga Waller.
President of the International People's Democratic
And at the Manchester, Movement. England Conference, Luwesi Kinshasa.
Secretary General of the African Socialist International.
While U.S. and European economies are falling all around us, now we must seize the time. Take the future in our own hands. Join the African Socialist International, the African Liberation Day 2009. The Washington, D.C. conference will be held at the Carlos Rosario Charter School at 1100 Harvard Street Northwest. And the Manchester, England conference will be held at the West Indian Center at 74 Carmore Road. Register today at www.alduhuru.org. That's www.alduhuru.org. And take the future into your own hands. One Africa, one nation.
Africa Live.
What I'm saying is, ain't nobody gonna do this for us but us.
Africa Live.
Talk about a Barack Obama. Don't even talk to me about Barack Obama. Let's talk about Marcus Garvey. You know what I'm saying?
Africa Live.
The question ain't whether we vote for white power in white face or white power in black face. The question is whether we be an independent people or whether we remain colonized and oppressed until we are wiped out. This is African internationalism in action, y'all. Y'all need to get up on this. When we say we have to have power in our own hands, here we're talking about the African working class. What we can do is to have an organized capacity of the African workers in alliance with the poor peasants who takes state power for itself. Then we can begin to say we got justice in our own hands.
Africa Live. Africa Live.
Just raise up these incredible African leaders that we've had. It's critical that as African people we strive to be like them. I'm talking about the Marcus Garveys. I'm talking about the Fannie Lou Hamers. I'm talking about the Malcolm X's, the Kwame Nkrumahs, and today we have Omali Eshetela. Brothers and sisters, Africans at home and abroad, welcome to Africa Live. Uhuru, and welcome to Africa Live, Voices of the People here on uhururadio.com. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and I have in the studio with me today, Comrade Chairman Omali Eshetela, the Chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, and Chairwoman Penny Hess, Chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee. Uhuru, comrades.
Uhuru.
Uhuru, Africa.
We've got a great show lined up for you today. We'll be talking about a few things, including the case of Lavelle Mixon in Oakland, California, who, before being gunned down by the occupying army called the Oakland Police Department, took four of them with him. There's been a hailstorm of response to the organizing work the Uhuru movement has been doing to raise up this courageous example of resistance, both in support and in opposition. So we'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about the African People's Socialist Party itself, which built this radio station and is involved in work to lead the struggles of African people throughout the world. And we're going to kick all this off today with a discussion about the economic crisis and even a little about the G20 summit that is to be happening in Europe. So I'd like to start us off with a clip of a news report on comments made by Brazil's President Lula da Silva at a press conference with British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. This is Lula da Silva.
Da Silva is calling for the G20 to sign off on a $100 billion fund to try and halt the huge drop in global trade. The Brazilian president told Gordon Brown during talks in Brasilia that if next week's meeting in London became just another meeting, then the crisis will get worse and hit the world's poorest the hardest. Mr. Lula also blamed white, blue-eyed bankers for the crisis that he says has brought the world to its knees.
This crisis was not created by blacks, nor Indians, nor poor people. It was a crisis that was created and spread throughout the world due to the irresponsible behavior of white people, blue-eyed people that thought they knew everything, but are now showing they knew nothing.
This is interesting, because this is from Lula, who as president of Brazil has been one of those forces who's kind of straddled the fence, sometimes supporting some of imperialist projects and other times, you know, supporting projects that are for Latin America. How should we see this statement from Lula, Chairman?
Uhura, I think that it is telling, because what is happening is that the world is moving closer to a realization of the parasitic relationship that Europe and North America has to the rest of us, and is willing to articulate this. It is incredible that you would have a press conference like that with Lula standing before Brown, who has represented, who comes from a country that has been associated with imperialism for hundreds of years now, and most of the governments of non-white people, you don't find, you know, even the audacity to make that kind of statement. So I thought that was interesting. I think the other thing, however, that was missing from that articulation is a kind of recognition that that the crisis that's being described at this moment is given significance primarily because it impacts on Europe and North America. But the reality is that Africa, Latin America, Asia, most of us have lived with this crisis that began a long time ago, and the crisis created by white, blue-eyed people was, as far as we are concerned, is part of the crisis that even gave rise to something that is now called Brazil, to the political economy of the world. The political economy of the capitalist economy, the world economy itself, rests upon the body of humanity as a form of crisis for us, and has for the longest period of time. You have a situation now where Brazil has entered or been invited into this thing they call the Group of 20, which is an attempt to expand the parasite, to bring up countries who were primarily victims of European and U.S. parasitism up until the pedestal with them as a means of an expansion, as a means of protecting the whole system. And so now you hear a different kind of characterization, such as that by Lula, and I imagine you will hear some other kinds of criticism, but the criticism is not of imperialism itself, just how it has the world economy seems to have been manipulated by Euro-American imperialists. Nevertheless, I think it's really important that we are beginning to hear this articulation, and the fact is, of course, that they are many, 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 many years behind. I'm talking about Lula in terms of the analysis that that we've made some time ago about this relationship. And Lula, I didn't know that he was flip-flopping. Usually Lula has been right dead smack in the middle of the imperialist. He's sent forces. He sent people to Haiti to help impose imperialist solution on our folk there, most brutal kind of solution. And if someone remembers, it was when Hugo Chavez was there for in Brazil for, I think, the social forum, I think it was, and when Lula took the stage, people in from Brazil booed him, and it was only Chavez who was able, you know, to get them to quiet down a bit. So his politics and his policies have been quite in sync with imperialism since he has become president of Brazil. So it's very interesting, and I think it's telling that he has achieved the kind of boldness. It's a statement of the crisis of imperialism that Lula is able to say that, and his boldness is not something that's out of the blue. It is also because of the relative difference now in relations of power that that is occurring, you know, throughout the world.
Penny, you got anything you'd like to?
Well, I think the question of the G20 meeting, which is going to be opening Thursday, April 2nd, in London, is the number one economic question right now as the world economic crisis deepens. And I really appreciate the analysis the chairman just gave, because it's really being summed up in, you know, sort of the undertones of the crisis of the once colonized world versus parasitic capitalist imperialist centers in a certain way. It's being noted for its tremendous anti-American sentiment that's going to be showed there. I know that there's a lot of demonstrations already going on in London, including one, I understand, by the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, which already happened. But they expect during the meetings that there will be huge, possibly even, you know, rebellious demonstrations going on there. I do think that, like the chairman said, it's important that to note that Lula made those comments when Gordon Brown was the Prime Minister of Britain, was there on a visit to try to garner support for what he's trying to do. And Brown is really unpopular inside of the UK right now, because he was the finance minister of Britain during the time that a lot of the derivatives and the immediate kind of economic crisis that the banking industry and is filtering down to the people are experiencing. He's responsible for the policies of that. We also know that Russia is calling for the ditching of the dollar. They're going to be proposing that during the G20 meetings, and China is saying that they want a new world reserve currency, which is a whole other very interesting discussion, because as I heard it summed up on one radio station, it might have been NPR, that they were saying, well, that will never happen because you have to have the strongest military in the world to uphold the world's reserve currency. So it's an interesting question there. But I think that what Gordon Brown seems to be doing is fighting for white power in a really blatant way, and I just wanted to read some things about that. This was in today's New York Times. The title is English-Speaking Capitalism on Trial. And it starts out by saying, sitting in a gilded upper room at 10 Downing Street last week, listening to Prime Minister Gordon Brown outline his ambitions for reforming the world economy had something of an out-of-this-world feeling. with Mr. Brown seated beneath the 16th century oil painting of Queen Elizabeth I, it was tempting to imagine for a moment that Britain was again rising grandly to the challenges of the age in the way of good Queen Bess. And of course, she was the queen that initiated the trade in African people with Sir John Hawkins, who was a slave trader that they called a pirate, working under her. But I think that it's important to know that the G20 meetings are going to be held in what's called the London Docklands, and specifically at Canary Wharf, which is today the center of the current financial district of London. But that was the center of the docks for the slave trade, the trade in enslaved African people. And even just a year ago, there was a replica slave ship docked at Canary Wharf as a tourist attraction. And I think it's interesting that it's right where a gallery opened about a year and a half ago called the Museum in Docklands, which is the first gallery or museum of the slave trade in London. And it just to say what it says about that, it said the gallery called London Sugar and Slavery will reveal how London's involvement in slaving has shaped the capital since the 17th century and will challenge what people think they know about the transatlantic slave trade. It will debunk the myth that London was a minor player in the trade. I don't know what myth that was. By showing that it funded much of the city's industrial and financial success, from Jamaica Road to the Bank of England, from the merchant houses of Blackheath to the nation's art collections, profits from this most lucrative trade shaped the metropolis. It just goes on to say, and I think it's just interesting, it says, perhaps the most challenging part of the gallery will shed light on the vital role that Africans played in liberating themselves from enslavement, their resistance to accepting a life of slavery, and their rebellions in the Caribbean islands forced the British establishment to rethink its economic and foreign policy and inspired the public to help campaign for abolition. Visitors will find themselves questioning the real motivations behind the abolition legislation, discovering Britain's continuing relationship with its West Indian colonies, and be challenged to think about the long-term effects of the slave trade on London and Londoners today. That's just in the heart of where the G20 is, and I just think that's all very telling and symbolic of what the crisis is, as the chairman described it today, of the once colonized people and now under neocolonialism peoples of the earth struggling against the pinnacles of white power, whose wealth and power was built off the backs of African and indigenous peoples.
Well, I do think that's important, because when you talk about a crisis, and Lula is talking about this crisis being caused by white blue-eyed people, I mean, think about what was the crisis being experienced by people and families and territories that were at the heart mm-hmm. of the theft of their relatives and their people from Africa, coming by the British and the other, like, imperialists. Mm-hmm. I mean, this crisis for us has been going on for a long time, and it has been the crisis given rise to capitalism, the crisis subsequent to it, because it has continued to rest upon the enslavement, the exploitation, the oppression of African and other subject peoples. So Lula really still hasn't got to the heart of the question. It's going to be difficult for him to do that, because even when you look at a place like Brazil with varying numbers given to the percentage of the African population, I mean, that goes really high once you get past this thing, this different, you know, how the Portuguese, you know, mm-hmm. characterize Africans with these different degrees of who we were. You got this huge African population. Then, of course, what the Portuguese did, the colonizers, white people, you know, colonized Portugal. This territory of that thing we now call Brazil brought Africans, so many Africans there, and then appropriated African culture and called it Brazilian and called themselves Brazilians. And it has been a really interesting kind of situation because many Africans who live in Brazil will say, well, there's no racism here because there's the African culture, there's, you know, everybody is a Brazilian, et cetera, except the Portuguese, you know, came up with this characterization and appropriated, you know, like African culture, and the Africans catch a natural hell in that, territory. So Lula, you know, it's important for him to say that, but just because a territory that was once colonized and even where racial ideology was used as a justification of that colonization, just because it's no longer colonized does not mean that it is a part of the solution against capitalism. Doesn't mean that it's anti-capitalist. Doesn't mean that it, you know, that it represents the destruction of the system. Because part of what we're seeing in the world today, in portions of what they call the Middle East, etc., and Latin America, and in Asia, is increasingly people who were previously countries, territories that were previously colonized, are now being invited to become a part of the larger parasitic body on the rest of us, precisely because they have overcome some of the economic limitations that have been imposed on them by their relationship to capital. It doesn't mean that the peoples who live in these territories in Brazil and places in the Middle East and Asia will hereafter have advantage of the product of their labor power any more now than they did under white imperial power. There might be some vicarious feelings that people will have, such as with the election of Obama here in this country, that by virtue of a black person, those who need it can say, well, black people are capable, you know, to be exploiters as well. But I think it's really important for us to understand that this is a social system that is blood-sucking social system, and they will let you marry their sister if it means the salvation of the system itself. And, of course, that was a joke about a later fear that white people seem to have about you. And their sister. It might have been more of a statement about their sister, really, if we think about it, but that's another question.
Right. But even when we're talking about you know, nations that are no longer colonized becoming a part of this thing, we're talking about nations that are still, you know, under like neocolonialism, right?
With, not, you know, necessarily neocolonial any longer. I mean, because some of them actually taking control of their own economies. A neocolonial situation is one where the former colonizer still owns and controls the economy. If you got neocolonialism, this is effective. You don't have to have a G20. It's at that juncture where the indigenous, in fact, they might be called, how do you characterize it, patriotic nationalists, you know, like a Lula, maybe. And they are patriotic in the sense that they hate imperial white power for taking resources and filling space that they, a domestic class force, feel like they should occupy. They are the ones who should be sucking the blood. They are the ones who should be owning the mines. Not that the mines should belong to the people and the resource, but they should have it. And so they are patriotic. They oppose what white power is doing. You find that in the Middle East and Asia and various other kinds of places. And people actually step forward with an anti-white, anti-blue-eyed attitude. But that attitude is because they, as a class, and you got to remember this, every class conscious of its own interests identify its interests as those, as that of the whole people. Right. So when they say Brazilians feel like this, you know, they're talking about you know, that class force that's conscious of its interest, that's in the mix and capable of struggling and attaining power. So there is this transformation. You see it happening in India. Of course, China started off, you know, in pretty good shape in terms of having an aspiring bourgeoisie right there, that where the imperialists never, at least for the longest period of time, owned and the most of the economy and what have you, and so it doesn't necessarily mean it's a neo-colonial power. Those people who are emerging now, not necessarily neo-colonial. Now you have a situation like South Africa, which I think is also a part of the G20. There you have a kind of domestic neo-colonialism. In the sense that, for lack of a better term, how do we characterize this? Where you have a group of the settlers who control the economy for the longest period of time, now control the economy through, you know, Negroes who they've allowed to manage the economy and the country for them.
Forces who live in these countries and are oppressed by the national bourgeoisie, how would they be characterized? I'm just thinking in terms of, because before, you know, under neocolonialism, they would have been characterized as colonized peoples, you know. But in this new situation, how would we characterize those persons who are oppressed by their own national bourgeoisie?
But what you got to remember is that this is we're in an era of transition, tremendous transition. A whole new era of struggle is opening up right now. And what you have is where a situation is not what it was and not yet what it will become. And I think that it's an incredibly significant period of transition where the struggle for national liberation, it still means the people have the responsibility of assuming control of their economy and their sovereignty, but now in the mix, in a much deeper kind of way, is an emerging national bourgeoisie that the U.S. is attempting to, not just the U.S., but the whole, primarily the U.S., but the rest of the imperialist world is attempting to drag into it. And not only that, but you have some situations where, you know, Comrade Penny just mentioned that China's talking about a new reserve currency. And you know, there's growing speculation that China is feeling capable and strong enough to begin challenging the U.S., you know, for leadership of the whole world economy. That's an incredibly significant kind of situation.
Yeah.
So there is emerging a national bourgeoisie, but it's still a state of transition because it's neither, you know, like an absolute European-dominated situation. And what you got to remember when we say European, you're talking about France, Germany, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and U.S. You're talking about all of these forces, but when you talk about the others, we still have not seen the consolidation like in Latin America. You're talking about in Brazil, but there's also all these other places in Latin America. So, you have this force that's attempting to emerge, and it is serious enough. It's very serious, and left to its own, you would see that the worst fears of the imperialists will be realized. I think that's part of what is happening now. Just how it's going to work out is something that we have to help to determine. We have to help to determine how that's going to work out, because this period of transition is not something that the national bourgeoisie that's attempting to emerge has done themselves as a class, but as a consequence of people's struggles. And so the peoples have to assume leadership of our own struggle against imperialism and therefore define it, as opposed to leaving it in the hands of this emerging national bourgeoisie, who would define it not as something that brings social transformation and the emancipation of the masses of workers, who can then come to control and possess the value of their labor. It is just to readjust the relationship so that other emerging bourgeoisie can participate in partaking of the pie that the workers produce. I hope that wasn't too convoluted.
Yeah. I don't think so. You're listening to WhoRadio.com. This is Africa Live, Voices of the People. I'm your host, Nyabinga Zimbabwe, and I'm talking with Chairman Omalia Shetela, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party, and Chairwoman Penny Hess, the chair of the African People's Solidarity Committee. We're talking at the moment about the G20 and the developing world situation. Penny, you were about to raise something.
Well, just to say, just on the question of China, I mean, it seems like it's possible, or what do you think about this, Yaron, that the one reason, I mean, that China is in a deep symbiotic or, you know, parasitic relationship with the U.S., or in a relationship with parasitic capitalism. It has made a lot of money off of, you know, what capitalism has been doing in the last few years, and that it seems like it's possible that the reason that they're starting to say, the bourgeoisie, the national bourgeoisie, is starting to say things like that they are not that interested in buying the U.S. debt anymore is because of pressure within from their own people. Because it would benefit the people for China not to do that, although it wouldn't necessarily benefit the bourgeoisie as much. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it would, you know, like in the short term, benefit the people more. And I say in the short term simply because what we're talking about is the people having access to more of the value that's created,
exactly,
that they create.
Yeah.
So I think that we've heard of instances where there have been demands from different sectors of the population that they stop buying up U.S. debt and that more money becomes available to the population, you know, itself, so that the population, so there can be a really domestically developed economy, a domestic market can really emerge in a decent way. There's sectors of the bourgeoisie that I imagine would like to see that happen as well. The question I think that they are confronted with is a strategical question in terms of when would be an optimum time to do that and what would be the consequences of a move at any given time based on the relative strength that they experience compared to the United States. The fact that China is talking aloud about doing this right now may even be a bargaining, a negotiating tactic that it's using to push the United States to try and adopt policies that China and some others feel are more favorable to them at this moment. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they are experiencing pressure. There's evidence that they are experiencing pressure from below to stop buying up U.S. debt and what have you, and to begin a process that will allow these resources to become more accessible to the people.
And we want those of you out there who are listening to participate in the discussions that we're having here, you can do so by calling in or emailing in. You can call our U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599. That's country code 001. You can call our UK number, which is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. Or you can call us for free through Skype anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. So email us at dj@uhururadio.com.
I think it's important in the related to the last issue that we were talking about in terms of China, to recognize that there's a tremendous amount of struggle that's happening in China. You know, on a regular basis, demonstrations, strikes, on a regular basis, because the working people in China are catching hell, generally speaking. And China can enjoy such an incredible growth, economic growth. I think they said something about China may have had some kind of reversal from what 12% growth rate to 8% growth rate, but then 8% in most places just incredible.
Yeah.
And so part of the reason China is able to move so quickly economically is the depth of the exploitation of the workers and the peasantry right there in China. And so there have been incredible struggles, incredible corruption and what have you is found there, as you do in all of these emerging capitalist economies. Whenever you see that, and these resources, you know, flowing in a fashion as they are with these new, I say emerging capitalists, you know, kind of, you see this kind of corruption and what have you. So there's a lot of struggle on the ground there, and I think that this struggle is not something that can be overlooked in terms of the earlier, the totality of this discussion about the contest that is occurring that has resulted in the growth of the group, the attempt for the U.S. and Europe to include all these other economies into the decision-making group, that even in these economies there's a lot of struggle going on, and so it's not going to be as smooth as they would like, as they would like to think it's going to be.
Go ahead, please.
Just, I mean, I think that what people say is that China is the only country in the entire world that is at this moment in history equipped with a very developed industrial manufacturing infrastructure in place, and that so therefore it's poised to come out of this in the best way. But the issue is, again, that the resources that China needs to make that manufacturing successful primarily come from Africa. And so really the question of who controls Africa's economy is really key to the whole world and the whole question of the African Socialist International, that you know, united Africa would be the dominant economy, economic power in the entire world. And it's just really powerful to, you know, to think about how this is shaping up in that way.
I think that's right, because you're talking about the industrialization of China. I mean, when did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
When did that happen? You know what I'm saying? In the last several years. And one reason, just based on the other part of that discussion is that that observation is that China does not have the natural resources. It's
got
to go other places to get the natural resources. It's got the people.
Right.
And it's got the labor power and the numbers and what have you that it has. And if it has a market, then, of course, it has a huge market that the imperialists want to tap into, et cetera, that China has used advantageously, the labor market, advantageously massive production for the imperialist world, for China, etc. But Africa, you see, has this problem. Even though it has this tremendous resources that everybody wants, it does not have any kind of national, coherent strategy, economic plan, or anything. And it cannot have it because the imperialists divided Africa in the way that it did. And you have all these little fiefdoms, competing, crawling all over each other to see who can do the best belly flop at the feet of, you know, the next imperialist master, whether it's in Europe or China or any other place. And that's why, and all of this is at the expense of the future of African people in Africa and around the world. And that's why the African Socialist International is critical. Africa cannot develop without having a unified Africa and African people, all of whom represent incredible resources for Africa once freed up from imperialist domination, once unified. Then Africa has the people, it has the land and the resources, it has the skills scattered around the world, and is located in strategic places that gives it and around the globe that gives it an incredible potential. But that potential has to be unleashed, and it's going to take a revolutionary movement to do that. Otherwise, we'll spend another 500 years of folk living off Africa, And despite the fact that Africa has produced all these resources for several hundred years, you have to recognize that those resources are finite, that they won't last forever, and at some juncture, Africa is going to have to use its resources, both human and material, for its own benefit.
Yeah.
You're listening to Africa Live, Voices of the People, here on AhuruRadio.com. We're going to take a quick break and come back with discussion about a situation in Oakland, California, where 26-year-old Lavelle Mixon, who was killed by Oakland Police Department, took four cops, before they killed him, and the mobilization and action that's going on subsequent to that case. So stay tuned here for Voices of the People, Africa Live, here on AhuruRadio.com.
Shut to the stakes, by the stakes, my little homie got clapped by the jakes. The state carry weight in and out of state. That's how it is when you trapped by the stakes. Trapped in the stakes, by the stakes. My girl band got snatched by the jakes. Africans get paid at holiday. That's how it is when you trapped by the stakes.
Welcome back to Africa Live, Voices of the People, here on AhuruRadio.com. I'm here in the studio with Omalia Shetela, Chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, and Penny Hess, Chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee. I want you to participate in the discussions that we're having here. You can do so by calling in or emailing in. You can call our U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599, and that's country code 001. Or you can call the UK number, which is 020-8133-6629, and that's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype for free anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and that's all one word, all lowercase. Or email us at dj@uhururadio.com. We're going to talk about the case of Lavelle Mixon, who was killed resisting the police occupation in Oakland, California, of the African community, and in this case, four cops were killed, and we're going to play a brief clip before we go into this discussion. This is a clip from a march that was held by the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement following this incident.
It's real talk right here, man. He gonna be missed. He ain't gone nowhere, man. Lavelle Mixon, man. That's what we screaming out here, man.
East Oakland King. East Oakland King. 82nd and Burke.
That's my cousin, man.
Oakland police have to do it like that. Always messing with somebody. That's what I gotta say.
They always want
to
shoot him.
They always want to shoot somebody.
We're here today to do no different than what you saw yesterday, as they paid their respects for their slain comrades. We pay respect for a young brother who we felt symbolized the resistance of African people who are terrorized daily by the police force, which are an occupying army in the African community. And not just here in Oakland, but all throughout this country, you see every day black people are dying at the hands of the police. Oscar Grant was no blip on the radar screen. Only thing that made Oscar Grant what it was caught on video. So we look at Lavelle Mixon, who was not political, who was not an activist, but who took the stand that we hope people take in terms of resistance to a very vicious, a very brutal colonial system where the police are the first arm of the state, and that the police do not represent anything good in the African community. That's a historical fact. I don't make that up, and that's the reality that we deal with. So again, Lavelle represented that, and we're here to pay respect for a brother who we think took a very righteous stand in the face of all kinds of terror that comes down in our community at the hands of the police.
Must go! Must go! Must go!
The march in itself is a symbol to organize people and let people know that there's another side of the coin. There's a voice out here. This is the voice of the slave. What you heard yesterday was the voice of the slave master. The reality is we're a colonial people who are oppressed, and we want economic development and social justice is what we demand.
He's a true hero, a soldier. A lot of people wouldn't come and say, oh, he was a fool for killing them police because they were scared to speak out. But my cousin went out like a boss, a true boss, a real black man, not scared. We send our condolences. Don't think we are monsters. Don't make him out to be a monster because we not like that.
I am. Power concedes the power, and what we're about with the Hoorah movement is trying to organize for black power, just like what we saw here in the 60s with the Black Panther Party.
We are doing a vigil here in the black community for our black beloved brother, Lavelle Mixon.
So that was a clip from a march that was held following the incident in Oakland, California. Chairman, there have been a lot of responses to this action, and there's been an attempt to put this incident in isolation. Can you give some context to what it is that we're looking at here?
I think this is an important struggle. The bit of immediate history is that the police say they stopped this young brother routine. They call it routine traffic stop. You know how many of us get stopped routinely? It's a routine traffic stop, which, you know, simply statement that they were harassing somebody. I remember another routine traffic stop in October of 1966 in West Oakland, where Huey P. Newton was stopped, and it resulted in the shootout there. And of course, Newton was wounded, and the cop, I think it was Fry, Officer Fry, was killed in that process. And so here you have another routine stop, this time in East Oakland, California. And this brother, as it was we heard in the clip, was not political, not as far as we know, part of any kind of organization. The stories differ. The police say it was a routine stop, and he just shot the police. We've heard subsequent to that from people in the community that Lavelle Mixon was driving a car with a door that was impaired, and it wouldn't open, so he had to crawl out the window to get out of the door when the police stopped him. We've heard that the police, this one cop, knocked him back into the car when he was crawling out, and that is where the shooting came from. This is, you know, like I said, there's some dispute there. Of two cops were killed. Their story is that Lavelle Mixon escaped from that scene, and they tracked him somehow to, I think, his sister's house, and they got there. And another two cops, they say, were killed by Lavelle Mixon, and he was killed. So that's the story. Of course, there's controversy there because we've learned since that time he was killed in the closet. He had 57 bullet holes in his body. His family says that when they went to the funeral home, he had been shot 57 times. And some people are suggesting that the cops shot themselves, that the two dead cops there shot themselves. But be that as it may, that's not the fundamental issue. The issue is that when the Uhuru movement in PDOM held a vigil honoring this person who was killed by the police, the madness came from everywhere. I don't even know how to describe this frothing at the mouth guy who is a radio talk show thing, Savage, hosts something called Savage Nation. The insanity, the just racial hatred that he was spewing, and then the O'Reilly Show. These are anti-American people who were having the vigil. We've got so many hits on our websites that they almost crashed us, didn't crash us, but and people have been calling most racist garbage, leaving messages on our phones and through emailing, just the worst kind of racial stuff, threatening to boycott economic institutions and march on them, and that kind of thing. In one instance, Bakri Olatunji, who leads the work, who was a leader of that work, who had become a spokesperson for that work out in Oakland, California, anyway, was on the O'Reilly Factor, and he didn't know it, but they had brought in a good Negro in the form of a former mayor, a former state legislator, California state legislator, Willie Brown, who the term Slick Willie should have been coined for. And so he had this Negro, saying how terrible things were for us as a Uhuru movement to recognize this person in the face of the fine, honorable police officers who had been killed. Some people who are even friends of ours were troubled. They say because these men were killed, they have families, et cetera. And so what they've done is they've taken this and they've personalized it. They've taken the individual policemen who were killed and they've personalized it. They've taken Lavelle Mixon and they've personalized it. They've said that the cops have subsequent to murdering him said that they subsequent to them killing him, they discovered that he had raped somebody, that some DNA showed up that showed that that indicated that he was guilty of having raped a 12-year-old, and there we are defending a rapist who shot these honorable men who are there to defend the peace and what have you. And it's I think, a really important and timely discussion because even as they were having this discussion, they've had to say that the African community has a whole different take on the police department. They've had to say there's been these issues between the police and the African community. Even Willie Brown, when he was on a rally factor, had to agree to the points that were being made by the Uhuru movement, by the unjust arrest and killings of African people and numbers of people who are in prison, etc. So the thing is, first of all, the action itself the Uhuru movement made it impossible for them to do what they traditionally do, which is to have used this shooting as a way to demonize the African victim and to demonize the African community and to justify putting more police in the streets. They can't say that now. They're saying there's somebody out there who's holding up this guy and who's talking about what the police represent, and then they actually got other Africans who have nothing to do with this saying what the police are in the communities. That's really, really important. But the thing is this, that we should never forget, is that even if we didn't know the names of the persons of the cops who were involved in it, even if they treated their mothers nice and took down, helped, little white ladies across the street, even, if they donate to the local charity things that they're involved in and participate in the Police Athletic League. The reality is this, that their role is an institutional role. They function as a part of the state. And the state as an institution, as an organization that emerges in human society at a time where society is split between haves and have-nots, at a time where those who have as a consequence of expropriating value that's created by those who do not have. The state is an organization for the purpose of coercion. It is the means by which the ruling class attempts to achieve a monopoly of violence. It is the fact is that the ruling class is not against violence. It wants to monopolize violence, and the state is that instrument through which it attempts to achieve a monopoly of violence. The thing is that the state, it has been deified, and many people who call themselves revolutionaries, for example, out in Oakland, there's a handful of so-called revolutionary Negroes. They are militant, this and that, and they talk all this talk, but we haven't heard from them since this shooting and since we did the action. None of them has come to say, wow, we are really glad that this action was taken. This is a profoundly important thing, because without knowing the names, again, whether they went to church on Sundays, whether they did mass, etc., what we know is that our relationship with them is not as individuals who go to mass, who help little ladies across the street, but our relationship with them as instruments of state power that are there to maintain the status quo, that are there to protect the system from the efforts of people like ourselves to change our relationship to imperialism. So that's what it is. I think that's important. And this has got nothing to do with Lavelle Mixon. This has got nothing to do with the people who killed him. That's just the objective reality all the time. Mm. That's what the state is. So this attempt to personalize it, say, oh, and to bring the weeping widows, from the cops, as they normally do. And it's not even a situation that sometimes people would have us say, well, you know, he was a good cop. He didn't do this or do that. The fact is that it's the good cops who are the worst cops. The fact is that the bad cops can be, these are the ones who drink on duty. These are the ones who do all this other kind of stuff. And yes, they are vicious, etc., and they undermine the police. It's the good cops, the ones who do what they're supposed to do, when they're supposed to do it according to the rules. These are the ones who are the most effective in maintaining this relationship of the oppressor state, the oppressive state, against the rest of us, in particular the colonized people such as ourselves. So this is what we have to have an excellent opportunity to help people understand, to move our folk and to move whomever we can away from this romantic notion of the poor individuals who got shot, just like the poor individuals who go to Afghanistan, the poor individuals who go to Iraq and get killed. And some of them may be my relatives, maybe your relatives, but they are armed of imperialist state, and the people have a responsibility to fight against their occupation, whether they are in Iraq, whether they're in Afghanistan, or whether they're in Oakland, California. It is the responsibility of those of us who are occupied to resist the occupation. Now, Lavelle Mixon obviously was not conscious of this. We see people killed in our communities every day who are not conscious of this. But it is our responsibility, those who are, of us who are conscious of it, to raise that issue, to turn this incident into the political act that it was, even if it were an uninformed political act. Because what is it that the state is doing in this instance? The state, in the form of the police, is there to maintain this relationship of poverty, joblessness, of the humiliation that African people suffer every day, so that we always experiencing routine traffic stops as they are characterized. That's the state. The state is the entity that dropped the bomb on folk in Philadelphia, that's got Mamiya locked up in prison today. And so this is the reality that we are talking about. We have an opportunity to educate people around that question, because the state is attempting to maintain this relationship. Lavelle had been in and out of prison, out of jail. How many of us is that true of? How many Africans, for example, you have a situation where, what is it, one out of every eight African young men is in prison? You know, and perhaps 45% of the African population in this country has a relationship to prison, either in prison, been to prison, on parole, in jail, on probation, this kind of thing. That's the state at work, and so it is acting that way to maintain this relationship. So, when you have somebody who fights against the state, who robs a filling station. It's somebody who breaks the law, which is the opinion of the ruling class, which is created in order to maintain the status quo. Most instances, it is not informed by political understanding, but those of us who have the politic, who have the science, have a responsibility to give it the political characterization and take it back to the masses. So that if Lavelle Mixon had survived this situation, he would know better what motivated him and what his act meant than he did before he died. But he became a symbol because he struck out at elements of the state that are there for the purpose of keeping us enslaved. That's the way that is, and that's how we have to understand it.
Whoa, I appreciate that. And Chairman, you know, is the fact that they could not paint the picture that they wanted to of this situation without having to admit the fact that the police have this terrible relationship with the community, the African community. Is that fact an indication of weakness on the part of the state, or what does that indicate?
It's in this instance, it is an indication of the significance of having revolutionary organization on the ground. Because the only reason the state is in this situation is because of our intervention, which is why we are so hated, which is why they condemn us, and that's why every liberal, Negro and white, is quivering even as we have this discussion right now, who are claiming that you're too out, far out in front of the masses, who never want to do any kind of thing that would challenge this relationship in concrete terms, who will write and send letters to Obama and things like that, but who will not take any kind of action in defense of the mass of the people, and then going beyond the question of simply defending ourselves, but actually struggling to end this relationship that we have with imperialism. And if every African in Oakland were politicized and had the courage and the organ and this young brother Mixon had, and had the organization and politic, think of what it would mean in terms of our relationship to our status as colonized people right now. Think of what that would mean. If every African with that courage had the science, the politic, and the organization, what kind of situation imperialists would have to contend with? And that's why they don't want us talking about this. That's why they hate us. That's why they don't want to see that vigil. That's why they don't want to hear a summation of that that relationship. They want to personalize it and keep Mixon as somebody who they say DNA showed that he raped a 12-year-old and killed these honorable people who are keepers of the peace.
We want you out there who are listening to this discussion to participate in the discussion we're having. You can call in one of our various numbers. You can email. You can call in to the U.S. number, which is 727-565-1599, and that's country code 001. You can call into our UK number, which is 020-8133-6629. That's country code 44. Or you can call us through Skype for free anywhere in the African world. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, and it's all one word, all lowercase. Or email us at dj@uhururadio.com. We have an email that has come in. It says, Uhuru, Mixon Action is right on. It says, Uhuru, I was heartened to see the movement stand in action in response to Mixon's murder. A teachable moment. The chairman's analysis, as usual, is correct and timely. Long live the Uhuru movement, our vanguard. And this from Efia Nwangaza from the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination.
Uhuru.
And you know, Chairman, it's interesting. I was looking at this situation, and I see like even the one of the cops who was shot, not one of the ones who was killed, but one of the ones who was shot, had himself been responsible for the murders of two African people, and responsible for having left one another young African paraplegic.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that, you know, getting past the falsification that the imperialist media puts out there. I mean, looking at just the facts themselves, point directly to the analysis that you're putting forward now.
They can't stand facts. It's like after 9/11, you know, when people were saying these white people in states of hysteria saying, we don't know, we don't care why they did it. We don't care why they did it, just kill everybody. Mm-hmm. They can't tolerate facts. They don't want to be able to see this relationship. They want to be able to maintain a purely visceral, subjective response to it. They don't want the thought process. And listen, I understand that, because there was a time when even as a political person, you know, I was very subjective about the police. I just didn't like cops. I had any... because cops are, you know, forms of humiliation against our people. They stride into our communities with their guns, and they do all kinds of nasty things that people are familiar with who are listening to this right now, in terms of how they treat women, how they, you know, just the terrible things they do, how they humiliate families, etc. And anybody who has African, most African, particularly men, know that you can look at a cop a certain way, and that cop is going to either arrest you or do something to harass you. That's just the reality that we have with the police. Mm-hmm. And even middle-class Negroes, you know, have the situation where when they're driving and the cop, they see the cop in the rearview mirror, that they have this really anxious moment that mm-hmm. they have to deal with. But this, I had this visceral thing about cops. I just couldn't stand cops. And I was personalizing it. You know, and the thing is that the police are an instrument of the state. They are institutionalized force there. And the state exists in every society that is split by class. In a society where class is, you have this organization that's called the state. And depending on where you're located in the world, the state forms and has formed itself differently. And if you look at a place like America, or look at Australia, and how the bourgeois state consolidated itself in Australia, killing off the Aboriginal people, they were ordinary white people, these civilized blue-eyed people that Lula was talking about, went and just murdered the African people there in the most brutal kind of way. I mean, it's hard to even describe what they did. Look at how the state got shaped and forged in what we call North America today. Killing, taking the land of the indigenous people and killing it and holding that land, taking the land that's used to be Mexico, especially the so-called Texas Rangers, Indian killers, attack against people, the Mexican population, the slave catchers. All of this stuff is the stuff through which the North American state was forged. And this is what gives us its character. This is what is responsible for how it acts. And then, of course, it has to maintain these relationships, because the Mexicans are still alive. And they still cross that border. And so they have a police organization characterized and treats them in a certain humiliating kind of way. And the African people still don't have freedom inside this country. So we have this terrible humiliation. And they are starving, you know, throughout this. Yes, we are literally starving in America. Africans are. You look at the ratio of wealth that exists between Africans and white people in this country, the amount of wealth that's there, and you see that Africans are literally starving. Look at the poverty rate in places like Oakland of the African population, and then you have to have these armed forces in order to maintain it and keep people from rising up to take back what belongs to them. Even if they're not conscious of being Africans, people won't tolerate the kind of treatment that we get, the starvation and poverty and what happens to our children in the schools, etc. The state is what's necessary. The police department, the so-called SROs, the school resource officers that they put on campuses, all of this stuff is necessary to maintain this kind of relationship. That's the state. And that's the entity that's going to have to be dealt with. That's why we have these, like, cultural nationalists, you know, who are so you know, you do your little black thing, et cetera, and you hate the honky and you hate the white man, and et cetera, but don't understand that the power of the state is what maintains this relationship that we have with imperialism. That's what's going to have to be taken on, and you're going to have an organized capacity to do that. And guess what? The state is not going to surrender. But what Mixon has shown is that when we resist, we win. Right. You know, I'm told a story. Perhaps it was Tupac Amaru. Perhaps that's who it was. This story, by the way, was told to me by Mafrika, who was a BLA force. I won't call his name because I think he, you know, is relatively respectable today. But I first met him when visiting a federal prison where he was locked up. And he was telling me about this when the European, the Spaniards first came to the Americas. And the indigenous population thought that they were gods because there was a story about how white people in the myth. And so they thought these guys were gods. And so, but they treated the people so badly. And this one Indian, perhaps it was Tupac Amaru, I'm not sure, who followed one and caught him by himself. And when he caught him by himself, he stabbed him, he killed him, and then sat with the body for 3 days to see if anything was going to happen. Like, oh, they can die. They can die. You know, so this mystique, you know, and what Mixon did, impact the mystique. What the Black Panther Party of the 1960s did was they took on the mystique of the state. And the state attempts to, if you ever notice when you go to a court, this is what the state attempts to do. It attempts to give itself some kind of deification. The courtroom is much like a cathedral. You know, the high ceilings and what have you. You've got the altar, and you've got this guy like a priest in a robe sitting behind it and what have you. You have speaking hushed tones and all of this. The whole thing is to build this mystique so that even the victims of the state respect what it is that's happening to them, or respect the institution that's doing it to them. Do the time, do the crime, do the time. You hear convicts saying this kind of stuff. The state wins this kind of deification and appreciation for itself. And that's what was significant about the Panthers' demystification of the police, the characterization of the cops as the pigs, and demystified them and even taught the police who they were. Mm-hmm. So we know that they're an occupying arm in our community, and this is just an incredible, as someone's mentioned, teaching moment about the state and our relationship to the state.
Another thing that's interesting is seeing, you know, even how these forces, you know, a lot of stuff that you're seeing happening across the U.S., you know, in terms of like people killing their families or killing, you know, going out and killing a bunch of folk. A lot of them are police or used to be police or were trained as police. It's interesting, you know, that and it seems to me like that, if explained correctly, could help to demystify the state as well.
Well, Chairman, that was a brilliant summation of that situation and the question of the state. And I think that I feel that because of the work of the party, the African People's Socialist Party and NPDEM, in this, that it has turned it into a turning point around that question. You know, in the whole country and maybe even in the world, in terms of what resistance is and the whole question of national liberation again. And I think that I think that what happened in Oakland is significant also because the resistance of Mixon came within less than 3 months after the entire world saw on video the police in the form of BART police shoot an African young man at point blank range. Who had been subdued, who was on the ground in handcuffs, just shot him, just pulled out his gun and shot him, and people could see that. And it, you know, and that's not unusual. That's what happens. It's just that, like, you know, has been said, it's just that people had their video phones with them. It was in the middle of a BART station and took videos of it from many angles. So I think that just in terms of the Solidarity Committee, organizing in the white community, that, you know, we, from APSC, we've been putting out what the conditions are for many years. But it's interesting how, in spite of everything the state is trying to do to demonize the Uhuru movement and to uphold its own legitimacy, what's happening is sectors of white people are having to admit what the real conditions are. That white people knew were there, always knew were there, whether you're talking about the poverty, the unemployment, the constant police harassment, the unjust prison rate, all of that people know, white people know. But in all the boom years where white people made all the money off of the prison economy, the drug economy, and everything else, nobody would talk about it. But it takes this resistance for people to begin to see it in the white community. And I mean, because the state has done everything possible to criminalize the African community since the defeat of the Black Power movement of the 60s. And that is breaking down. And just like the resistance of the Vietnamese people, and as you always say, Chairman, and U.S. soldiers coming back in body bags in great numbers helped white people inside the U.S. to begin to see that they should stand on the side of the Vietnamese people, then, you know, this resistance, especially articulated as the Uhuru movement, the revolutionary organization, does, helps white people to see it's in our interest to stand in solidarity with the liberation of African people.
I think that last part of that statement is the key thing, because it's not just the resistance that forced white people to have to see it. Because if the Uhuru movement had not intervened,
yes,
it'd just been another dead person. The African people had just been demonized. African community would have been demonized and criminalized again. It would have justified the call for more cops, more police. As Dellums, who is the liberal, you know, radical mayor of Oakland, has been bringing in more, the African mayor of Oakland, bringing in more and more police anyway. It would have been just justification for that. But what happened was that it had a political character, and I can't, because of our intervention, and that's a crucial intervention.
Yes.
I cannot overstate the significance of that, because resistance happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no interpretation of it that forces folk to have to deal with it, and that's the issue. That's the thing that sent Clinton into St. Petersburg, Florida in 1996, mm-hmm. when the rebellions here happened after the police had murdered this young African, because it the rebellions had a consciousness. It was able to articulate the basis of the murder and the relationship that African people have to colonialism. That's what's happening. That's why Comrade Diop was choked out by the police in the City Hall of Philadelphia just the other day when he was challenging Nutter about the budget bomb that's being, we compare that, talk about the budget bomb, because they bombed the African community in Philadelphia under black mayor, the first black mayor, you know, in 1985. That's why he was attacked, because we come forward with an explanation, political explanation. And this thing with Nixon and this question of the state, this is a crucial thing. Mm-hmm. And because it is, I mean, Pancho Villa wasn't a bandit when left to the definition of the imperialist.
Right.
You know, and all of the acts that's been made by revolutionary forces, that's why they have the Bush needed to characterize any act of resistance as terrorism. That's why General Alexander Haig, who was the first Secretary of State under Ronald Wilson Reagan, said that they were going to make it a policy to characterize freedom fighters as terrorists. And so they are trying to take away the political definition that we have to bring back to this question and help people who are involved in resistance, who would naturally try to resist if they understood what it was about, and to help the whole colonial population understand what's going on. And if Africans are armed, if Mexicans are armed, like with an understanding of this relationship, then white people look quite foolish standing out there by themselves, you know, seeing this insanities, and then also expose themselves to as folk who want to maintain this same kind of relationship. And some white people who have claimed to be our friends are now have expressed some disappointment and disillusionment because of what our stance. And if what they are trying to tell us is that they will be our friends as long as we do not uphold our community that's resisting state terror, it's a friendship that we don't need and that we don't want. The fact is that we have an obligation to do that. And, you know, it's like saying, okay, we know that all of these bad things happen in the community. We have accepted a kind of willingness to do some charity, to help the poor, this kind of thing, but the poor must never resist. And that's what the state is there for, to make sure that we never resist. And for them to be crying crocodile tears over the state, whose purpose is to maintain this relationship, and not be able to sympathize and empathize and unite with the victims of the circumstances that the relationship that the state is attempting to protect. Mm-hmm. Don't drop that on us. That identifies who you are, not who we are.
Yeah. Right on. You're listening to Africa Live, Voices of the People, here on thewhoradio.com. And we're going to take another break here and come back momentarily. We're going to talk about the party itself, the African People's Socialist Party itself, that has been leading so many struggles on the ground throughout the U.S. and in other areas around the world that challenge the imperialist state, challenge this relationship, this parasitic relationship between the U.S. and Europe and the dispersed African nations. So stay tuned, because we're coming right back with that discussion.
Yeah.
Uhuru, and welcome back to Africa Live, Voices of the People here on UhuruRadio.com. We just got done talking with, well, first of all, we're talking in the studio with Chairman Amalia Shetela, Chair of the African People's Socialist Party, and Penny Hess, the Chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee. And we just got done talking about the situation in Oakland, California, where 26-year-old Lavelle Mixon was killed while resisting the police occupation of the African community. And in that incident, four of the members of the occupying army were killed in the process, and one who had previously killed two Africans and left another paraplegic was shot. I want to let our listeners know that stay tuned, because on the next program, Who Are on the Move, we'll be talking with organizers on the ground there in Oakland, California, as well as members of the family of Lavelle Mixon. So stay tuned for that discussion. It's going to be a great one as well. I want to move into the next section of our program today. You know, all of the work that we've been seeing, from mobilization around the situation in Oakland to the challenge of neocolonial governments, both local in places like Philadelphia and others, as well on the national and international scale, in the challenge of Obama and even the challenge of the G20 summit. To the conferences to build the African Socialist International that are happening in various regions of the world. All of this is led by the African People's Socialist Party, sometimes directly and other times through its mass organizations and other organizations. So I'd like to talk a bit about the African People's Socialist Party itself, because even as the party is involved in changing the world, it is itself developing. You know, I want to ask, first of all, Chairman, we see, you know, party forces boldly challenging, you know, imperialist authority. And even in some cases, like that of Comrade Colonel Alpha Mba, who's in Kenya right now, building for the ASI conference there that's to happen on April 9th and 10th. We have forces going into places where they've never been before, with you know, limited resources and under difficult conditions, making some great things happen. Is this an example of how, you know, how party forces work in general, or are to work in general?
These are the best examples of how the party should work, and they're important examples during this period when what passes as revolutionary activity of quote unquote progressive work is usually something done by NGO types that expect that they are going to be brought to different places and participate in conferences that's been sponsored by some sector of the imperialists or the other. George Soros, I think, is one of the most significant interveners in this fashion, helping to pay for conferences. And a lot of people call themselves progressive. They get together and they talk about different things. But you mentioned Colonel Alpha Mba, who has done most of his work in West Africa, has built under the most difficult kind of circumstances a massive organization out of Sierra Leone, Liberia, touching in the Liberia, Guinea-Conakry, and then, you know, their comrades, and who Colonel, who left there to go to East Africa, gets to Nairobi, where we have a conference happening on, what is it, the 8th and 9th, 9th and 10th, 9th and 10th of April, to build the African Socialist International. Doesn't have transportation, gets a bicycle, travels all over by bicycle, a city he's never been in, massive city he's never been to before, hooks up all of the contacts, makes contact with both the Cuban and the Venezuelan embassy, wins their endorsement and probable attendance for the conference. And, you know, you've got comrades like Luizi Kinshasa, who Congo-born, living and organizing in England, organizing the African Socialist International Conference to happen, ALD, in Manchester. Just one of the most selfless forces that you can find. You've got comrades like Diop Olukbala, who travels throughout the United States and, as you know, was just recently choked out by the cops in a meeting in Philadelphia. And, you know, there are others like that, but those are some of the best examples. And the fact is that as an organizer, I mean, I traveled for something like 8 years, you know, as an organizer with just a red suitcase filled with books and organizing throughout this country, you know, like building the party. And that is, you know, like who we are. That's represents the best of who we are. And like I said, under difficult circumstances and our forces now, you know, people who have sacrifice, if some would call it, what could be opportunities to be successful within the space allocated for successful Negroes by imperialism, have chosen instead to cast their lot with imperialism. Look at Comrade Aisha Fields, mm-hmm. A PhD and a physicist who you know, works and, you know, doing. Building, you know, for the African Revolution, for, you know, here and around the world. That's who we are. And I'm proud of that. And because the thing is that what we have done and what the best of us do when we come into the party is to place our faith in the future of the masses, in the future of the revolution as opposed to the future of imperialism. Some people, you know, hedge their bets, and they expect imperialism to be here forever, and so they make plans like it's going to be here forever, and others of us recognize that we cannot have a future unless imperialism dies, and that imperialism can die, will die, at the hand of an organized masses of our people, and that's what we do, you know. So, yeah. That's the kind of organization when we function at our best and when we have the best of our cadre. That's what we've got. That's what we look like.
Is there such thing, Chairman, as a kind of person that that would be in a revolutionary organization? You know.
Let me, before we go, I'm going to extend this discussion if you don't mind, because I mentioned some of the cadre there, but you know, they're members of the African People Solidarity Committee, who've been in this work for more than 30 years. Mm-hmm. There are people in that organization who've, you know, faced jail. You know, there's Harvard-educated woman who, you know, leads much of our work. I think she's in Philadelphia now, isn't she? And there are, you know, people who... Oakland. You know, people who, you know, they go to work for the white people, and then they work, you know, like for the revolution. And, you know, most of the, many of the solidarity forces, the African people, they've been in them 20 years, 30 years, and that kind of stuff, and doing incredible work. Been jailed, been beaten by police, you know, in this work. I mean, that's the best stance and that we have. Now, not everybody in our work is like that. One of the striking things is that since I think something like was it October, you know, since something like October, I think we've lost what, 4 or 5 members of the Central Committee, right? And you know, we've had people who bail out. Some people were frightened by this experience that we've just had with the Oakland situation, mm-hmm. which is fine, you know, because it gives us an opportunity, because we're building a steel cadre. Everybody gets tested. That's what the thing. That's why practice is so important. Because everybody can be a revolutionary, right? But to be a revolutionary means that you got to go beyond just the discussion, and you got to take a stance in the face of a lot of difficulties. And that's the kind of organization we are forging. That's why we hold up examples such as some of the forces that we've just mentioned, because that's what has to be emulated. So. Yeah, and you were, what was the question you were just raising now? What type of person?
Yeah, you had begun to.
Yeah, I just think that, you know, I think we're looking for people and looking at people who come into the party who really have a capacity for a certain kind of selfishness and a certain kind of humility. Doesn't mean that folk don't have style, because they do. And of course, as you know, style requires vanity. But the thing is that I think that there is a kind of style and vanity that assumes the identity of a people. I don't know if I can say this, you know, well, but the thing is that like it's the opposite of the humiliation that African people experience as a group, you know, and we take it and turn it inside out. We mm-hmm. you know, and we are who we are for the people. And right. generally speaking, you won't you know, like, times get difficult. I don't have to tell you this. I mean, you know, times get difficult, you know. And the thing is that the force we're talking about is somebody who recognizes that even under difficult times, like we have to show high levels of morale for the masses of the people, no matter how we might be experiencing things as individuals ourselves, right. you know. And because this thing, we can win, and as long as we remember that we are servants of the people, and as long as we don't believe too much in the articles that we write about ourselves in our newspapers, and don't get carried away by them, and maintain, you know, like you know, humility and what have you, you know, we'll be all right. Yeah,
I was, you know, I was having a discussion with a comrade, may have been yesterday or the day before. And we were talking about, you know, the fact that, you know, it seems like in this period, you know, we're going through forces more rapidly, or I know there are more forces coming in, but there's also the question of, you know, like things that people could do before, and it kind of, you know, didn't have the same kind of consequences, have different consequences now. And we were talking about it, and saying, like, you know, how one thing about it, you know, people come in with all kinds of contradictions, but the thing that is that, you know, that people are able to you know, let their will be, you know, subordinate to the will of the organization, or the will of the you know, the general will, you know, as opposed to, you know, individually, you know, making their own stuff more significant than the whole.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, the thing is that to be what we're talking about is a revolutionary organization, revolutionary party, and that makes certain kinds of assumptions. One really important assumption is that the question of leadership, that we believe in a very serious way in this question of leadership, and sometimes we call on people to lead, and sometimes they do well, and sometimes even if they don't know a lot, they do well, they try, and they fight, and sometimes people are arrogant and they misunderstand, they bring in their interpretation of leadership from their experiences, things they've seen and read, and they do poorly. But leadership is fundamental. We don't think you can have a revolution without leadership. And we also, what that means then is that, and if we are talking about revolution, it means that the system is not going to concede anything to us. That revolution is a struggle for power. It is not a struggle for love. It is not a struggle to be accepted. It is not a struggle to prove ourselves to the white man. It is a struggle for power. The people must have power over our own lives, and that power has to be concentrated in the hands of the producers, who are the workers and the toiling masses, the peasants, etc. So it is a struggle for power. And it is a genuinely revolutionary organization, also struggles for science, a scientific method. scientific method of investigating and interpreting the world. We have said that in order for revolution to occur, there are certain things which are necessary to exist. There must be crisis. The ruling class must be unable to rule in the same old way. The masses must have concluded that even death is better than living as we live now. We've seen instances of that where people have fought tanks with rocks and sticks and what have you in different places in the world and including in this country in the past. We've said that in order for there to be revolution, there must also be revolutionary organization, revolutionary party that is guided by scientific revolutionary line theory. And so all of these things are prerequisites. The revolution won't just happen because you're mad. All of this is necessary. And we also recognize as African people that our status as a people in the whole world is a consequence of Africa coming under assault, African people being dispersed around the world, African people separated out from each other by borders, artificially created borders in Africa and around the world, and African people separated from our resources. And so, you know, you have this rich continent with poor people who are dispersed and separated from each other. So we say that we have to build a revolutionary party, a party that doesn't simply explain how bad things are, but a party that is learning and struggling every day to increase its position so that it can assume power. It can take and wield political power. And it recognizes that if we are to be free, we're going to have to take it. Therefore, what we have to do is organize, put down on the ground, every place Africans are located, organizers, party organizations that function as the advanced detachment of our class, whose objective is to organize masses and to struggle for power that ultimately will lead to the liberation, unification of Africa and African people around the world. That will be the advent of socialism, not only, we believe, in Africa, but worldwide. We think that's how it would happen. But it means that it's a serious business of creating a certain kinds of organization. Just any kind of organization won't do. It has to be an organization based on discipline. And discipline is not something, you know, like the mafia where they shoot you in the kneecaps if you don't act right. You know, I say the mafia, but police do that too. But it is a discipline that is voluntary. It is a discipline that comes as a consequence of people being united with the goals, the objectives, the theory of the organization itself. And if we're talking about making a revolution, it means that individuals do submit to the will of the organization. It means that the minority does submit to the majority all the time, even if it's something that you don't particularly agree with. And you might have, if you lost the vote, you lost the vote. That's the direction that it's going to go in. That's what's necessary to make a revolution, because you can't make a revolution where every individual does what he or she wants to do. You can't even know what direction you're going to. You have to have an organization where there's unity of will and unity of action, and where there is a relationship between what we like to refer to as thought and action, a relationship between theory and practice. Well, you don't just believe something, but you do something. A white guy named Karl Marx once talked about how in the past philosophers could be satisfied just to explain the world, but what we have to do is to change the world. You can have a pretty pristine explanation of reality if that's all you want to do is explain the world. But if you're talking about changing the world, then how that happens in the real world is most often different from the explanation of the world, you see. So we're talking about building genuine revolutionary organization, and and discipline, the requirement for discipline, the reality is that an organization comprised of people who have come to understand that revolution is our profession. That, you know, we may have different kinds of occupations, you know, we work and do other kinds of things, but our profession is revolution. We are professional revolutionaries. That's the kind of organization that we have to create if we want to be free. No people on earth who've been oppressed have ever won their freedom without first building an organization of steel and tested cadre that could make it happen. That's what the party is about, and that's our constant endeavor.
Uhura. You talked about a few things, including discipline, you know, and, you know, I do want to bring to the attention of our listeners that in the most recent issue of the Burning Spear newspaper, we printed a document called Democratic Centralism. And I would call on our listeners to, if you don't have a copy of the Burning Spear newspaper, to get that and to read Democratic Centralism. This is one of the main principles of the African People's Socialist Party.
It's the basic organizational principle of the party, is Democratic Centralism. And the piece you're talking about, I think, was done in the 1930s mm-hmm. by the Chinese Communist Party. It's a good piece, and we use it in our studies to help people understand this question of democratic centralism. It also helps people understand the question of leadership, which is profoundly important, because we won't get freedom accidentally. Mm-hmm. It's going to come as a consequence of having built the organization with that's guided by clear revolutionary theory and led, you know, by valiant men and women who have freedom as our ultimate aim.
Now, Chairman, we talk often about the crisis of imperialism, but how does that crisis affect people who are inside the Revolutionary Party?
Well, the thing is that I'm glad to raise that, in the sense that, you know, that just because you come into a revolutionary organization, it doesn't mean that you come into some kind of sterile situation separate from society. People in the party are also of society itself. And what we find often is that people who are in the party, some people in the party will accept the crisis of imperialism as their own. They experience crisis because of the whole world around them is collapsing. And it's easy to be for the revolution when revolution seems to be far away. But when revolution seems to be on the horizon and crises related to the potential for revolution are with us, then it forces a lot of people to second think their relationship to the revolutionary process. And they will often abandon the revolutionary process and do things that unite with imperialism. Sometimes they are conscious of that's what they're doing. Sometimes they are not conscious of that's what they're doing. Sometimes they do it in the name of securing their families, or because, you know, they want to, you know, take care of their children better, et cetera, as though it's possible to do that under imperialism. It's not. So imperialism will creep into your bedrooms, into your love affairs, and challenge you in the most serious way. And part of this whole testing, I think it was the Mao who used to talk about one of the most important struggles that we are involved in as revolutionaries is the struggle against self, you know, and which is a struggle against subjective interest that we might find. You know, we can always find, you know, I used to do like powerlifting, weightlifting, and what have you. And there's a thing that you learn when you're going to lift a lot of weight, certainly if like squatting a lot of work, and you pick up this iron on your back, and then you come out, you got 400 or 500 pounds on your back. You want to pick it up out of the rack, step back, squat it, and put it up within 10 seconds. Because if you hold it up there too long, your mind kicks in, and what in the hell am I doing standing here with all this weight on, you know? So the struggle against self is a really important aspect of the struggle, and sometimes we wake up dealing with imperialism and the consequences of being engaged in the struggle and ask ourselves the question, you know, and I think this is in the Solidarity Movement, where some person, perhaps it was the Solidarity Movement, I think went to do his laundry or something like that, threw his clothes out the window and disappeared. As of, you know, it got tough, as opposed to simply saying, you know, I don't want to do this anymore, right? And we've had other folk in the party, you know, who abandoned ship, you know, in the middle of the struggle. So when things have got difficult, and so, but this is a whole good process of, and we're glad that it happens now, because, but don't be surprised. I mean, like the Russian Revolution. I remember less than a week or so before the actual move by the Bolsheviks to seize power, two members of the Central Committee of the Communist Party went and informed the authorities that they didn't plan to seize power. You know, so in the middle of crises like this, people inside the party are also affected as well, and some in ways that are detrimental to our efforts and detrimental to themselves. And that has happened with us. And yeah. But it's a part of the process of actually building the kind of organization that we need to win.
Yeah. You know, I'm struck always when I hear people make like excuses why they can't be in the party, like you know, like they got to take care of the kids and stuff like that, because you know as somebody who recently has had children, you know, I didn't have children. My wife actually did, but you know,
we'll accept it.
But you know, like there's a different kind of feeling that I got, you know, than yeah. what these people yeah. say. You know, yeah. like I got the feeling, you know, looking at them, I got the feeling myself, like, damn, I can't leave this yeah. thing for them, you know. And it motivated me more. To make this struggle, and now you know, I'm always struck by that. You know?
Your effort is not to raise a slave, yeah. you know. Is that? I mean, to have babies, you know. I mean, white folks used to actually get Africans and breed us, you know, to do work for them, and that's what we do. I mean, our responsibility is try to not to raise another slave that right. will, you know. You know, benefit this system, but to raise a slave, to raise a slave master killer, to raise, you know, for yeah. forces who will destroy this system, and it's really something. Somebody who claims to have some kind of political understanding on the one hand, to assume that their child can have a life under imperialism that's worth living,
right?
Know? Yeah, without right. struggling against it. Yeah,
right. Now we're running out of time, and so I just want to, you know, say that this is not the last time we'll have this discussion, because there's so much more that we have to talk about, just in terms of understanding, you know, a revolutionary party and how to be in it.
I'm glad. Listen, I know we have to go, but some of the forces are good at some things. Like we're still engaged in struggle inside our party, because there's some nastiness in the party that we're in the process of cleaning up. You know, in one of the people whom I mentioned even during this discussion in the United States is a leader who, on the one hand, who is brilliant one day and does other kinds of things, but the other thing's got a history of exploiting and oppressing women that is not going to be tolerated. In fact, is engaged in a serious disciplinary process even as we have this discussion. Mm-hmm. So the point that I would make is not that the party is perfect and everybody in the party is perfect. There's an ongoing process to acquire the kind of organization that we have to have and the kind of cadre that we have to have in order to win. Some people can stay in long enough to become that person, to become forged into a genuine cadre. Others can't. And most times when they can't, they don't say, hey, I can't hang. They find something wrong with the party, or, you know, something wrong with Omali Shatella, et cetera, and then they leave. But that's all right, because our objective remains the same. We are going to build a revolutionary organization. It's going to be one that is led by hardcore revolutionary cadre.
Okay, that's it for our time today for Africa Live. But stay tuned, because next up we have Who Are on the Move coming up. This is our special broadcast of commentary by Glenn Ford, who is the executive editor of BlackAgendaReport.com.
For many on the left, it was an article of faith that the election of Barack Obama would change the paradigm of United States and international politics, that the conversation would be fundamentally altered when a black man became leader of the sole superpower on Earth. How anyone could believe that one man's melanin could undo or even significantly alter an imperial edifice erected over centuries at the cost of hundreds of millions of lives and the extinction of whole peoples is beyond me. But wishful thinking and silly assumptions are washed away by events and the passing of time. In Barack Obama's case, it has taken only 2 months to demonstrate that white supremacy and its peculiar Zionist offshoot has no difficulty exercising its power and privilege through the agency of a black executive. President Obama has shown us, and very early in his term, that he is just as determined as his white predecessors in the Oval Office to maintain the global order created by the conquistadors, the colonizers, and genocidal maniacs of Europe and North America. Obama threatens that the U.S. will boycott the second international gathering on racism since the turn of the millennium, scheduled for late April in Switzerland. The conference is informally called Durban 2, in reference to the first such gathering on racism in Durban, South Africa, in 2001. George Bush pulled the U.S. out of Durban 1, claiming the deck was stacked against Israel, a state whose purpose is to maintain Jewish supremacy through an apartheid-like system in Palestine. In the interim, Israel has escalated its savage aggressions against Arabs within its borders, in the occupied territories, and among its neighbors. Thus, the question of whether Zionism is a form of racism is as relevant today as ever. Since 2001, the United States has been engaged in its own self-proclaimed war against Arabs and Muslims everywhere on the planet, and has intensified anti-Arab and anti-Muslim discrimination here at home. The racial order in the United States has, since 2001, developed even deeper layers of hatred and discrimination directly related to American imperial policy in the world, and of course, its connections to Israel and Zionist racism. It's past time for Durban 2, but Obama doesn't want to go any more than George Bush did, and for the same reasons. Imperialism is incomprehensible without an understanding of its white supremacist underpinnings. The European and North American imperialists are busy rewriting the agenda for Durban 2, so that whether they attend or not, the event will result in no indictment of white supremacy as a fundamental evil at work in the world today. Language related to reparations to Africans for the white worldwide savagery and people stealing that created the black diaspora is gone, written out, as if the cascade of Holocausts against Africa and Africans never happened. For centuries, North American and European power and privilege has been built on the degradation of people of color. Now, a black man has been elevated to a singular status. He uses it to reinforce the system of white supremacy and to write other black and brown and red and yellow people out of history. His name is Barack Obama. Why should anyone be proud? For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.